This is Pete Berthelsen with Conservation Blueprint, and this is the Prairie Farm Podcast.
I'm Doug Duren, a landowner trying to be a conservationist.
I'm Tabitha Panis, president of the Iowa Prairie Network.
I'm Ryan Callahan, director of conservation at Meat Eater.
Angela from Axe and Root Homestead.
Chris Helzer, the Nebraska director of science for the Nature Conservancy.
Judd McCullum from Working Class Bowhunter.
Taylor Keene, founder of Sacred Seed.
Ryan Bryson of Bryson Wildlife.
This is Luke Fritsch.
This is James Holtz.
Joy Van Weingarten.
Sam Sobel.
Phil Ebert.
Julie Meacham.
And you are listening to the Prairie Farm.
The Prairie Farm.
Prairie Farm.
Prairie Farm.
Prairie Farm
Podcast.
Prairie Farm Podcast.
Welcome to the Prairie Farm Podcast.
Every single year, we sell seed to a couple of major buyers in Iowa. One is Tallgrass Prairie Center. The other one is DOT, the Roadside Program. Those are honestly the two big ones. And then Pheasant Forever is a little bit in there. In the DNR. And what they want is they want local Iowa yellow tagged seed. Pete, why in the world does that matter?
Well, it depends entirely on your objectives. So as an example, if you're a landowner enrolled in the largest, most successful conservation program in the nation's history, the Conservation Reserve Program, right? Might not matter. You might not care if it came, the seed came from a couple of states away. If you are interested in prairie restoration, it's probably very deeply personal to you. Mm-hmm. If it's what you would call local ecotype. And then not only is it local ecotype, but how far away is it? And that's a moving target kind of for everybody based on their personal objectives to a project. And you'll probably hear that threaded into lots of my answers today. It depends.
Yeah.
And it depends on what the objectives are.
Do you feel like there are correct objectives?
Well, it depends on what you fulfill. There we go. Right out of the chute. Came up with it. I'll just tell you that at its core, Conservation Blueprint is a local ecotype seed business.
Yeah. Okay?
So obviously we care deeply and personally about prairies and about having increased access to these species that are just so incredibly hard to come by. So yes, it's very important to us, but there are also projects that we work on that are not prairie restorations. And we have to think about supplying form and function. What do they need in terms of form and function? And in some cases, it can't really be provided by local ecotype stuff. So I think that I come at things with really a broad perspective of trying to get the form and function. One of the things that I say all the time is I will take an acre of habitat wherever I can get it. I just want to make it the best it can be. And by I'll take it wherever I can get it. We're probably going to chat a little bit today about pollinator habitat. There are some organization and entities that say, if it's within 120 feet of active agriculture, you know, that's no good and it really doesn't have much pollinator value. I'll take it wherever I can get it. You know, you've very likely talked about the Prairie Strips program, born in the state of Iowa, and really important in that, that has a tremendous amount of value. I'll take it wherever I can get it, and then I want to focus on making it the best it can be. There's so little habitat out there that I don't think we can afford to be planting something that's kind of, you know, it's okay, but I want to make it the best it can be.
You know what is striking about you right from the get-go is you hold this tension. You're obviously an idealist. Nobody cares strongly about a specific ecotype, not only about prairie, but then get down to the minutiae of exactly what county did it come from? How can you get seed from the closest county you possibly can for the original source with a good, with still good genetics? Nobody cares about that without being an idealist. But then at the same time, you're not so hard that you're not unrealistic in what this world is going through and how we can connect with it. And it's people like you that actually come up with viable solutions. You know, if being an idealist is very important, that they can move things, but they can also get stuck. You know what I'm talking about? They get stuck on, hey, if it's not this way, why does it even matter? Let's just, you know, and then, and Kent and I kind of talked about this earlier, but people end up throwing out the baby with the bathwater, and you're like, hey, I understand we got to deal with some bathwater here, but we get a baby at the same time. Right. And that is really cool.
Just to follow up on that, Nick, I think particularly in this thing that I call it the pollinator world that's out there, there's a lot of people that draw lines in the sand. We're good. You're bad. We're going to be on this side of the line. You got to be on that side of the line. I refer to that as lumpers and splitters.
Lumpers and splitters. That's funny.
True taxonomist. True taxonomist, right?
My whole career, we'll probably talk about some of my career on today's call, where I worked on building partnerships. I'm a lumper. I want to bring as many entities together for the same overall mission as we can, because I think that's how you move the needle. Mm. And we need to focus on moving the needle.
Man, you know what? You know what's astounding is one of the reasons I believe that people have a hard time with Prairie is because they can't put it in a category in rows, make it very neat, like human anatomy. Our brains naturally want that. So it's kind of interesting. It's ironic that some of the people who love Prairie are drawing these lines, falling into that same trap of wanting things to be in clean categories. But instead of with plants and species, we're doing it with humans. But I want to step back to a few paragraphs ago where you said that, you know, you kind of talked about, hey, just how whatever kind of habitat I can have in, even if there's some compromise to it, is kind of the what I was hearing from you. What's an example of something like that you've worked with?
Oh, great example would be one of the kind of special sauces that Conservation Blueprint has is we work with the solar energy industry. Mm. Utility scale solar energy is kind of our special sauce right now, and we're working literally with projects all across the country in 28 states right now. And that's a great example of a project that may or may not be suitable for prairie restoration. Most of what we work with is the big stuff. We call it utility scale solar, 500 acres to 3,000 acres in size. Okay. Mm. Well, the industry standard for a project like that is that the bottom of the solar panels are a mere 20 inches above the ground. Okay. So think about this for a second. If it's 20 inches above the ground, one of my goals as a seed mixture guy that's designing the seed mixture is, how can I come up with something that does not grow taller than the lower panel height? Because if it grows taller than the lower panel height, what are they going to do? They're going to mow it. They're going to go out and mow it. And how many of our native prairie plants that all three of us get super excited about and want to see on the landscape can handle being mowed 2 to 3 times a year? And probably, no matter what we say, don't mow it this low, they're going to mow it at like 2 to 3 inches.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
There aren't many.
Yeah.
So when, you know, on a solar project, a smaller one where you might have a lower panel height that's 36, 48, 60 inches above the ground, the palette, the horizon is wide and it's open. And when I go to open my toolbox, all the shiny tools are there. I can kind of do whatever I want. On a utility scale solar project where I have that 20 inch limitation, I open the toolbox and some days I feel like I have a roll of duct tape and a rusty screwdriver. There just aren't many tools to work with that can check all the boxes, but we can still get multiple environmental benefits. It's just probably not going to be prairie restoration.
Yeah.
That's perhaps a good example of where I feel like I have to balance multiple objectives, but still keeping sight on that guidepost out in front of us that is, I want to have pollinator health and habitat benefits, soil health benefits, water quality benefits. I want to benefit grassland songbirds. I want to touch as many layered environmental benefits as I can.
How do you, practically, how do you plant 500 to 3,000 acres in between solar panels, right? You'd have to have like a little side-by-side or something, right?
Well, there's a number of ways. One of the ways that we try to do it is plant it before construction starts.
Hmm.
So then you can just plant the whole thing with a drill. Mm-hmm. You get a faster response. You get a better response. You're maximizing the use of the seed. And then we know that we're going to have 10, 15, 20% of it that's going to need to be replanted. But we still got the whole thing planted with a better outcome. If it is post-construction, you might be able to get a small Truax drill down the alleys, but there's a bunch of it that you're going to be broadcast seeding. So all kinds of things and considerations that you have to juggle on that. But I'm excited because I know that we have been positively impactful on getting increased pollinator health and habitat benefits onto the landscape.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Man, that is really cool.
So I'm just curious now. I can think of a couple species that would work well with that 20-inch limitation. I'm thinking buffalo grass in Canada, anemone or anemone, however
you maybe say even it. Prairie spiderwort, not Ohio, but prairie might be short enough to do it. What do you end up putting in there?
So now let's go to those examples. Great examples. In central eastern Iowa, I'm working with a 3,000 acre solar project.
Wow.
Is there enough Carolina anemone or candle anemone, or you pick it, to do 3,000 acres?
No.
That's a limitation. And then also, does it blow up the price of the mix? I'll give you what maybe we can chat about this later, because it will probably come up as a really good example of something that we have identified as a local ecotype wildflower seed that we want to get, is purple poppy mallow. Okay.
Wow.
If you're a landowner, if you live in a city and you have a nice lawn, you hate purple poppy mallow if it shows up because you mow it and it doesn't go away, and you want this pristine grass. Okay. Well, that attribute that you hate as somebody that wants a well-manicured lawn is perfect for solar. Mm-hmm. Doesn't grow taller than a couple inches, spreads, persists, an incredibly long bloom period. It's like 3 months. If you mow it, it just says, I don't care. You know, it doesn't bother me. Yeah. It'll persist in a grass environment, deeply rooted, all of those kinds of benefits. Here's the but. It has not been very commercially available to be able to be used. This year, because of our work in solar, Conservation Blueprint specifically targeted that and went out and hand harvested 167 pounds of it specifically so that it can be used in projects like that. Native, significant pollinator benefits, deeply rooted. You can mow it. It won't go away. I call it the golden child for utility scale solar. Man. We just have to get enough of it so that it's available to be used. That's one example of how we take our passion about local ecotype wildflower, our desire to really make a difference on something like utility scale solar, and bring those things together and try to figure out, okay, how can we identify a solution for this thing where, okay, great plant, but it's not available.
Yeah. Yeah, that is really cool. And we talked about this, I think, with Russ Benedict a while ago, how there was basically a data collection done where they were trying to figure out, okay, if all the conservation happened that we thought should happen, is there enough seed? And they
that was with the guys at Iowa Cover Crop, James Holz. He was the one that brought that up. Yeah, it was a very insightful point that he made.
And they were saying they were short of like 1% of the seed that they needed. It was like wild how short we were and how much seed was needed for what's out there. And something that's a little sad and something that we try to work with, but it is difficult. There's economic restraints on it, is how few species end up getting into CRP, because the industry very quickly narrowed down, hey, these 40, these are the best to grow. These are the least expensive, easiest to put in mixes, grow the easiest. Don't don't need to go out hand harvesting them. You can harvest them with a combine. And so there's kind of a narrowed, if I'm really working hard and someone wants to pay $1,000 a mix, I can put 100 species in there. But even 100 is very short of getting close to recreating, a remnant, or what used to be out there. And my goal the past 3 years is I've tried to add 3 species to each mix every single year, which means, so we're at the end of what we grow and can readily available. So now I'm working with hand harvesters in the local area. I've got a list of those and I just tell them, hey, these are the things we're really looking for. This is what we've had that's worked in the past. But then it's difficult because now I have to convince, I've got to represent the benefits of those more expensive mixes to farmers when they can go down the road and get less species, but for $20 less an acre. And, if they're doing 50 acres, that's not nothing, it's $1,000. So, so it creates kind of this restraint, but, we've done some with utilities, but it's usually through a third party, not usually directly work. But so what kind of restraints do they put on that? Are the utility companies doing this out of goodwill or are there government restrictions or requirements that they have to do it? What's causing that?
There's 3 reasons. One, the solar developer has a corporate sustainability platform that says, this is what we're going to do. It's actually quite common. We want to be providing pollinator health and habitat benefits and that sort of thing. That's one. The second one is the end user of the power has required it. Okay. Large international corporation that has a sustainability program where we're trying to get to net carbon zero, by 2030 or whatever. And they're going to use renewable energy to do it. And they want to have pollinator health and habitat benefits be part of that system. The third one is it's required in the local permitting requirements, their conditional use permit.
Okay.
And all 3 of them can come into play.
Yeah. What do you find typically is the utility companies, do you feel like they work well with you and they're kind of eager to do something about it? Or do you find
absolutely
that, really? Yeah. That's awesome.
Yeah, there are people that are listening to this, and as soon as you talk about utility scale solar, one, you can have a reaction about the loss of farm ground, because typically it's going on farm ground because that's typically the flattest stuff out there, targeted and that sort of thing. And then, you can have some people that just say, oh, that's just greenwashing, what they're talking about right there. Mm-hmm. I personally have not experienced that. We get to work with solar developers that have a genuine foundational interest in wanting to do something right for the environment, and it just has to work in all the other objectives of the project. Mm-hmm. And you can't lose sight of the fact that objective number one is the generation of renewable energy.
There's a company, I don't know if we've talked about this on the podcast. I'm going to leave their name out of it for now. I don't have any permission to say, but they reached out and they're doing 80 acres. No, it'll end up totaling 130 acres of a very, very diverse mix. And you know what they get for it? Nothing. I mean, they get cleaner water and helping for a better future. But my point is there's no government program. They just said, hey, we want to do this. We want to take, of their land, they want to take this much. And I'm shocked how many people there are out there, that have land that want to do what's right. And I find that fascinating. I was just actually reading an article written in December of 2023 saying that of farmland, only 56% of farmland in Iowa that's is used by the owner as economic sustainability. Everything else is owned for, because I mean they might make some money on it, but it's excess money because they're sentimental with it. They have it locked up in a trust so they can't sell it. And there was a third one that were like huge major reasons that people had it. But that's interesting with the farmers, because I feel like with the if 3,000 acre blocks were getting taken out of farming at a time, that would actually raise the price of corn for that farmer. I don't know.
Good. But just one other point on that is think, so that's a 20, 25, 30 year lease agreement where they're renting the ground, where their rates, you know, go up incrementally. Think about what that can do to stabilize that profit loss situation for that farming operation.
Yeah.
And there's a number of landowners that enroll a portion of their farming operation, but not 100% of it. So they're using it to kind of stabilize their operation.
Wow. Well, for everyone listening, this is all bonus material. We haven't even gotten into any of the outline that we sent Pete. For anyone who doesn't know, Pete knows what he's talking about. He's been in the conservation world a long time. You were, and correct me if I'm wrong, you were the ninth employee across all of Pheasants Forever. You were, Howard Vincent there when you were there? Or were you there before him?
Oh, yeah.
He was there. I know he was there kind of like in the volunteer stage. You talked about it being in a basement. Yep. But so what was your role when you were hired there?
So I was what was called a regional biologist and moved through several iterations with the organization and finished as the director of habitat partnerships. So really what I did was identify environmental limitations, conservation limitations, and then figure out how we could come up with solutions for things like how to get prescribed fire on the landscape, how to have biologists that are available to work with a landowner, and you're kind of the Swiss Army knife of conservation programs, where you could work with a landowner to bring together federal, state, local, private conservation programs and make them all work. That's now something that everybody knows as farm bill biologists, but you know, was there part of developing all of that stuff. So
yeah, man, I deal with government red tape and regulation and things a lot for my job, and it's a nightmare. I you are a hero for like pioneering some of that. That is really cool. So Pheasants Forever back then, that is such an interesting thing because it's a behemoth now of conservation effort. What was kind of their MO? What was it like to work back then? What was it like in the office with 10 other people?
So, well, number one, we were remote before that was called remote.
Before you could FaceTime in.
That's right. When I was hired, I packed up my dog and my pickup and I drove to Nebraska, young single guy, didn't know anybody, threw a dart on the map and picked a town to live in. And I covered the entire organization from Nebraska to Texas. Nine employees. Today in Nebraska alone, I believe there's something like 29 employees in Nebraska alone. Man. So the other kind of story that I would tell you is that back then, so this was 1990, doesn't seem that long ago, but apparently it is. back in 1990, local chapters pretty much put their dollars into food plots and planting shelter belts. Okay, so one of the things that I was proud of having an impact was really moving the needle on what Pheasants Forever did and where local chapters placed their effort by building partnerships where their dollars could be put into bigger efforts. And we started having a greater impact by putting grass and forbs on the landscape and not focusing on food plots. You know, so when I started, CRP was a thing. CRP started in the 1985 Farm Bill, really kind of started in 86, going on the landscape. The need to have a food plot in a 50-acre CRP field that's surrounded by corn and bean stubble wasn't real high, wasn't a high priority. But being able to change that planting from in the late 80s to early 90s, it was almost all smooth brome or switchgrass.
Yeah.
And having moving it the needle on those sorts of things was impactful, and having Pheasants Forever be part of offering incentives to get landowners to plant things differently and that sort of thing. So it's been a pretty significant change. And you, as frustrated as I get by CRP, and Nick, you alluded to it a little bit earlier, and we could spend an hour talking about that. As frustrated as I get, I also have the perspective that it used to be just smooth brome and switchgrass. We've come a long way from there, baby.
Yep.
So it's better, significantly better. And I don't lose sight of that fact, but there's still room for improvement.
Do you think the rates for CRP will go up, adding extra incentive for this next farm bill?
You mean the enrollment?
The payment rates.
No, I don't think that's going to significantly change.
Cool.
They're based on soil rental rates, which are based on cash rent. There's such a lag between when that data comes in and it impacts what the CRP rental rates are, that when cash rent goes up and down, CRP rates lag behind them. So when cash rent is high, CRP rates tend to be low. And if cash rent comes down and CRP lags, then that goes up. And that's where you get the problem of all of a sudden, some people are like, I can't compete with CRP. That's the problem, is where they're not, those two prices are not more closely aligned.
Well,
it seems like the old predator prey curve in biology class, doesn't it?
Nice. That's a good one.
Man. Yeah, Kent used to be a biology teacher, and yeah, they asked him to leave after the 12th kid. He made cry and run out of the room. It was just such
I invited myself to leave.
No, Kent actually cried and left the room, and after the 12th time, he said, I think where we get caught with CRP, we're kind of in this catch-22 where, I like the vast amount of acres that are in CRP. Mm-hmm. I'm not saying there couldn't be more, but I like the vast amount of acres. I just don't want to pretend that that's the end all. And I have seen some of the mixes that go out. It's really important to us that we get as good of a mix as we can while still being economically competitive. But then, you know, at the same time, I don't want farmers to get charged $500 for a mix when, you know, they're going to make $200 a year on it. And then it cuts that out quite a bit. Ted Cook.
Nick, you just made my point for me that we started the podcast with. It's about the objectives and the balance. You just said it the way, but we're absolutely talking the same language right there about, and also about trying to get the most good that you can out of every acre.
Okay, speaking of depending, I'm gonna switch gears a little bit on you. What is the difference in a pollinator plot and a prairie grass field?
Well, okay, so here's like number three, the third time where I say it depends on your objective. What's pollinator habitat? Well, if you are a beekeeper and you're thinking about honeybee health and how much honey can I produce, what are you gonna love the most? A field of sweet clover. Okay.
Yeah.
Would others of us consider that to be what we would envision great pollinator habitat to be? Probably not, but it depends on what your objectives are. Mm-hmm. So going back to what I've been talking about how we want to get the best out of every acre that we can, I'm focused on let's increase the diversity. And by diversity, I mean 40, 50, 60 species, which if you're a prairie restoration person, you'd be like, what? That's not diverse. You know, we need 100 and something. But if you're talking about CRP, that's incredibly highly diverse.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. And I think that the three of us have all been around long enough that we know that when just because you have more species doesn't mean that it has to cost significantly more. When we're building seed mixtures based on the number of seeds per square foot and sort of thing that we're all using, we get, maybe not everybody listening to this gets, but the take home message I would say is just because there's more things in it doesn't mean that it has to cost more, but because there's more things in it, something in there has a high likelihood of performing well for you, whether it's a hot year or a cold year. a wet year or a dry year. You're on the top of the hill, you're on the bottom of the slope. The more species that you have in there, eventually everything will sort out and everybody's going to find their happy home, and you have something that has a tremendous amount of diversity. For me, that's the goal. That's going to produce the most benefit, whether it's for honeybees or native bees or butterflies or grassland songbirds or pheasants or quail. You name it, the greater the diversity, the better off we're going to be.
Man, that dad talks about that a lot. He talks about, because he says, he's like, I'm not an expert of what's going to grow in your soil. You know your soil better. You know how much erosion or non-erosion, how sandy it is, how much sun it gets. He said, but if you just have really high diversity out there, he's like, something's going to work out. You know, something in this mix will work out. And you know what, I'm going to send you my, I'm working on our mixes for the spring right now. Before we got on and after we get off, I'll be working on them, and I'll send them to you. You can grade me on it. Tell me how good or bad I did.
Go ahead, Nick, Pete.
Just kind of put a point of emphasis on what you were just saying. I get to see what you're talking about every day because the Conservation Blueprint office is located on a 95-acre native prairie. Highly diverse, really, really, really cool. That's awesome. We see it every day where we have lots and lots of species, and you will only find them in specific locations on our property, on the side slope, on the bottom of the slope, on the top. And they just, our prairie, everything has found its happy home a long time ago. It's matured enough that it's able to keep things like brome and that sort of thing out of there naturally. But, you know, you will have species, and usually the ones that were the most desired and trying to find because they're so hard to come by, that are only in very, very specific niches, only on the north side of the hill, only on the side of the hill, only on, you know, just that kind of stuff. Yeah. So it really is a fun, enjoyable aspect of our job to be able to learn that stuff and just really have a fun time participating in it.
Guys.
Yeah. What I find to be interesting too is you're speaking from the context of Nebraska, and we're speaking from the context of Iowa. And some of the, I mean, they call the sand, you know, the prairie that you know, ranges across the Sandhills area of Nebraska. Mm-hmm. But honestly, it's bigger than that too, right? You know, I was just there a few months ago and was just blown away by how it's definitely not untouched in most spots. You know, there's been a lot of grazing and so forth, but unmodified maybe is
undestroyed,
a better word.
You know?
Yeah, right. The prairie that can exist there is a target that is more realistic is something like has always been there. Whereas in Iowa, it's so thoroughly changed. Yeah. Remnant prairie is just little scraps and little swatches around the state. And my dad said something really interesting in a conversation I was having with him. And he's a school administrator, a retired school superintendent, but he's just a very curious person, loves to learn. And I talked him into reading Charles Mann's book, 1491. Excellent read. And he said he actually read it twice. He enjoyed it so much. That's a big book. That's like 1,000 pages of reading right there. But he said reading that book cured me of wanting to make everything like exactly like what it was, because it showed me that this new web that we have woven as people, as we've modified the landscape, is so incredibly complicated now that to achieve the balances, first of all, you have extinct species that were a part of those original ecosystems. And so right there, there's been this plasticity that's had to happen to the niches that make up those ecosystems, right? And they're not entirely the exact same as what they were. And a new goal in his mind is, let's try and make them as good as we can. and and it feels so much more doable, and it really reflects the message that you've been communicating since the beginning of this, is how can I get the highest quality thing where I can get it. And I think it's important that we have that mindset when we talk about seed mixes, is maybe, and this is, you know, this can even go back to the lumper and splitter conversation on prairie reconstructionists. You know, there can be purists out there that, and, you know, I'm not saying they're right or wrong, but they might, you know, they might say that us having this conversation right now is not ultimately helping. But I don't know. In fact, I do know we're not going to ever have what we once had, at least in this part of the country, in Iowa. And I just think a much more realistic target, and that's what people need to see too, is a realistic target. When you're talking, Nick, kind of, you alluded to this earlier when you're talking about, you know, helping farmers get on board with buying a more expensive mix or a more diverse mix. You know, they need to see like there's going to be some kind of payoff here. Mm-hmm. Well, it's the same thing too. And hey, we need to restore the prairie. We need to restore the prairie. By the way, that's going to take, you know, well over 100 different species. Some of them, you know, they're not going to show up for 10 years in your prairie. So, you know, it just becomes so overwhelming to that. Again, going back to the baby in the bathwater situation that you mentioned as well, the whole thing gets tossed out because it's nothing we can achieve anyway. Let's go ahead and just seed it down in red clover or do a CP1, you know, that'll just be easier to mow off every year. And maybe I'll, you know, on some dry years, I'll get a baling allowance or something like that. You know, yeah. I think just having that realistic expectation is an important, maybe not the prettiest thing, but it's an important part of getting conservation work done.
Yeah. And it gives you something you could build from there.
Mm-hmm. Right. Yeah,
absolutely. Absolutely. I can't tell you the number of landowners that we get to work with where their land ethic has evolved as we've been able to work with them, and they become interesting. We're out primarily on private land, hand harvesting local ecotype seed, and the number of them that become interested and engaged in it, and what is this hairy, what is it, and you know, those kinds of questions, and just their level of interest, their land ethic has changed in terms of how they deal with their own property because of a passion that has been stoked. And typically these are people that are a little bit older, and their motives have kind of that needle has moved to where I want to have a positive impact on the landscape that is a little bit broader.
That's fantastic. Yeah. That's
right. That is really cool. When you say we are going out to handpick, is it you and one other person? Are there 50 of you guys? Or
no? So Conservation Blueprint has 8 employees behind I don't know if people see video on the podcast, but behind the door behind me is a crew of people that are back there working on prairie ragwort and compass plant today.
Oh, nice.
Cleaning that. So, so we have a crew of 8 people. So when I started harvesting seed about 20 years ago, just kind of as a side hustle with the access to our own local prairie and that sort of thing. And it's just evolved and grown since then, to where in 2017 we started Conservation Blueprint and decided, you know, this is something that we care passionately about, and let's kind of go all in.
Yeah. So you've just over the decades have found good spots to pick in various counties, and you can go out. That's really cool. How do you?
So Nick, you know, Kent already kind of talked about it, but we have a fair number of grasslands that are still intact and present here in the state. And the other thing that's unique about Nebraska is we literally go from short grass prairie to mixed grass prairie to tall grass prairie. We go from 11 inches of annual precipitation on one end of the state to 38 to 42 on the eastern end of the state. And so we have a wide range of things, a decent amount of grassland. And here's the other thing that we have in this local area. We have what's called a local prescribed burn association.
Really?
If your listeners don't know what that is neighbors helping neighbors get prescribed fire on the landscape.
That's awesome.
Wow.
That's incredible. That is
really when I was with Pheasants Forever, I identified that there were three limitations to a landowner being able to burn. I don't know how to burn. I don't have the equipment to burn. I don't have the people to burn.
Yeah.
So we came up with this prescribed burn association and a way of getting equipment to them and trainings, and it has completely changed the landscape in this area. So in this state, my local burn association is the oldest. It's been around since 2007, and we burn a significant number of acres a year for range management, CRP management, lots of different things. But I'm there helping on an awful lot of them. And what do you think the Forb response is on some of our native grasslands once we put fire on it?
Yeah, so they just start exploding.
So I have some great access.
Do you mostly do
land that way?
Do you mostly do fall time burning out there, or
I would say it's mostly spring, and we are encouraging growing season burns. And by growing season, I mean August, September sort of thing. You get a tremendous forb response, but people still think of burning as a spring activity in their mind. So, but we're doing more and more of it.
That is really cool. So I guess it's just volunteers, but it's just it's
neighbors helping neighbors. So this might not resonate with you, but in Nebraska, when I say it's like a branding where everybody gets together and comes together. So as a landowner, when I want to burn, I have neighbors, volunteers that have done this before that come and help me. And then when they need to burn, I'm there helping them. And as so the cost to me as a landowner is one, sweat equity. I'm there helping on these other burns. Two, you got to replace the drip torch fuel and that kind of stuff. And three, you got to feed them. That's it.
Yeah.
And it works really, really, really well.
That is really cool.
It's just a lot of camaraderie. A tremendous skill set from the people that have been doing this for years that are exceptional grassland burners and really know how to handle it and what's going to happen. And we're incredibly safe. And we just have a very significant plant of vegetative response to our burning in this environment.
Yeah.
That's great to hear.
I mean, yeah, you've put good work. You've worded it well, because it's a huge thing here in Iowa. You know, we're just like, no, please don't mow it in your mid contract, man. Please burn it. Well, you know, I've got four trees over. Like, okay, you know, it's just like, oh man. And I, you know, some of them don't even know. Like, hey, actually, like, your timber could use a good burning. You know,
yeah,
that would be good for it. But you know, and for us at Hawks, it's just a manpower thing. We can't be going out and you know, guiding the weather in the same season that we're trying to get things planted, trying to get our own stuff planted. And then we've got heavy weed management in that time. Well, so,
you know, that's the beauty too of it being, you know, when you talked about a branding, that's a cultural thing, right?
Yeah,
so now your burning association is a cultural thing. And
yes,
you don't need to worry about help then. This is just what we do in Nebraska. It's spring, therefore it's burning season, you know. And
15 years ago, you would never see burning happening in this central region of Nebraska where I'm talking to you from. This year in the spring, when you have one of those magical days for burning, you could stand on a high point on the landscape and look around and you can probably see nine smokes.
Wow. That's
awesome. We have completely changed the outlook and the perspective of prescribed fire in our communities. Yeah.
Something Ken and I have been talking about more recently on the podcast is moving the needle. You know, we encourage everyone to do something, even if it doesn't move the needle in a noticeable way. But what you were just describing is the needle being moved in a noticeable way, you know, for conservation. That's really cool.
I got to ask you, Pete, I think you're being a little modest here. How much influence were you on getting that burn association going back when it started?
Well,
he started it. He started it.
Yeah. That's a legacy thing right there. And that's something, that's something you deserve recognition for. That's incredible.
Thank you. As a landowner who's red card certified, I've been burning since 1984. I knew how to do it, but I still got into the trap of where I didn't have the people and I didn't have the equipment. So even though I was a prescribed fire believer and practitioner, I was still having a problem. So it's like, okay, this can't be insurmountable because we've solved bigger conservation dilemmas than this one. And how can we go about doing it? And it's really fun to see people that were, you know, 15 years ago, it was like, you know, we're trying to put fire out in local fire departments, you know, that are like, fire, you know, in this grassland environment, we can't do that. And everybody's attitude has completely changed.
Yeah. About That's so cool. Did you ever, have one get a little out of hand?
No, but I'm knocking on a piece of wood right now. So I would say, you know, it's called prescribed fire for a reason. It's this intricate kabuki dance of how you do things, when you do things, where you do things. And there's lots of communication and lots of water. And we're primarily burning in a grassland environment. And so if you have good fire breaks and your weather conditions are right and that sort of thing, it typically is a pretty safe environment. Now, having said that, one of the accomplishments that I'm perhaps the most proud of is when you have a crew of people and all the equipment and the food's cooked and everybody's there at the site and you say, no, we're not going to burn today because the weather parameters are not safe enough. It didn't hit what we thought it was going to be. And this is a no-go. That's not easy to do. It doesn't happen often. But when I see that happen and the people are smart enough to say, we're going to come back another day and try this one. We're not going to do it today. Yeah. That's when you know that you have accomplished something and you have really proficient prescribed fire practitioners.
That is amazing.
Yeah, it's an important thing because, you know, it's interesting. I just had a totally different conversation, but a related conversation last night with a guy who was on an elk hunt in Idaho, and he got himself in a really, really bad way. And he had to push the SOS button on his inReach, his Garmin inReach, to send in the chopper. Right. And, and he talked about like the mentality of that, you know, just the embarrassment, the shame. Should I do it? Should I not do it? I mean, he was dying. He was like, he definitely needed to push it. Well, then he got himself into a position because he was basically trapped on this side of this mountain during a blizzard that rolled in. It was going to last for 2.5 days. And, he was soaking wet and he found a way around to get off this cliff. And he said, at that point that I then got myself unstuck, I was still freezing to death. I was still, you know, miles from safety and I, you know, it's still snowing. And he unpressed his SOS. He turned it off because he felt this, like all that outside voice of, hey, you know, don't give in to the
imaginary peer pressure.
You know, I'm being a hassle, essentially. Well, that same exact mental space applies there on a burn day when all the people are there. Everyone's got babysitters for their kids. You've got all the walking tacos stacked up and the crock pots going and everything else. And you got to be the one that, you know, everyone's excited. Yeah. You got to come in there and be like, well, you guys can enjoy your walking tacos because they're not going to keep till next Saturday. So it burns off. Yeah. But that's important.
FYI, it's good. FYI, we've never had walking tacos, but we might consider it now.
Oh my goodness, P, you gotta have yourself some good walking tacos.
I'm just saying at a burn.
We've never had.
But it's important, you know, it's important to be able to do the right thing just because bad things happen if prescribed burns aren't done safely.
Yep. Absolutely. We were burning a field one time and Kent's friend was there with us and he was like, man, I should have brought my marshmallows. And that would, or was that you, Kent, that said that?
No, it was Caleb.
One to roast his marshmallows over the fire in the middle. I was like, well, I feel like we should pay attention more than that, but I just thought it was funny.
Probably.
Man.
Yeah.
Well, that's really cool. Okay. I got a question for you. What do you think of, the practice of, like, nuking with Roundup prairie fields to put down better established or better mixes?
Okay. So that's a good question, but it's a complicated question.
Yeah. One, it depends, right?
Yeah, absolutely. But number one, I live in an environment where we have a lot of grassland, much of it's degraded. I have seen native grasslands never been plowed, but they've been overgrazed. They're dominated by Kentucky bluegrass and things like that. I have seen them come back to being a high quality, highly diverse native grassland with the right management and, of course, the right amount of time. It's a marathon, not a sprint. It takes a little bit of time. One of the tools that can do that is the use of herbicides at the right time of the year, okay, to remove those cool season grasses that you want to get out. Here's my example. And then I'm going to give you the other side of the coin of where got to be really, really careful with how you do that. Smooth brome, as a wildlife biologist, is, you know, it's like almost the bane of my existence.
Yes.
Smooth brome has one incredible weakness. And that is that after you've had a hard freeze, and I mean, like, don't give me one hard freeze, give me like five of them. And if we've done a growing season burn where we've cleansed the palate of that field or we've hayed it or something like that in August and September, and that brome comes back and is flush and growing, and then we wait until November, December, and we have a day where it's 60, 65 degrees and sunny, and we spray it with glyphosate, it's like you go out with the tweezers and do nothing but remove the brome from that field. Okay. Think about everything else has gone dormant. And we know that there's no residual to that herbicide. It only impacts what's green and growing. You can impact anything that's going to have a rosette, beard's tongue, you know, penstemons, that sort of thing. So you have to balance that, but you can go out there and just hammer those Kentucky bluegrass and smooth brome species because they're still actively growing. Now, the other side of that coin, because there's some people, if they're driving while they're listening to this podcast, might have just drove into the ditch when I said that. The other side of the coin is that we have to be uber, uber protective of those environments. They're not common. They're incredibly precious and special. But what I'm talking about is a very, very specific management tool that we're applying to that. I am not advocating, let's go out and take a degraded native grassland, just nuke it, and then go plant all kinds of good stuff into it. We will get really incredibly cool things that you've never seen in that grassland that is in there somehow hanging on by its fingernails, and by stimulating it and taking away the negative competition, it can show back up. I see it all the time in our environment here in central Nebraska. So I'm not advocating wholesale spraying of that, but if done very precisely, it can be one of the tools that you have. And to a point that you were making earlier, Nick, I just wanted to reemphasize for people that there's nothing that we can do where we plant something and walk away from it and it's just, you know, all good. we're done. Yeah. We have to be doing a little something basically every year.
Yeah.
And if you do a little something every year, it doesn't have to be something big. If you wait until trees have encroached into your prairie planting or it's taken over by brome, you're going to have to do a considerable amount of more work to get it back to where you want it. But if you do a little something each year, you can have something that is really valuable, diverse, and functioning the way you want.
I think you're preaching to life right now. If we take care of ourselves and each other a little bit at a time, we don't have to, you know, worry about the huge mess ups later in life. But so with that, has there ever been a case where you've said, no, it's too far gone, nuke it? Or have you basically every time you've seen really degraded grasslands, you've been able to bring it back to life?
So we're talking kind of almost about two things. If it is a pasture, it's been planted and it's now smooth brome and that sort of thing, that's a nuke it, start over. Got a bunch of good plans about how we planted the soybeans for 1 year, clean the pallet, all that sort of thing. Yeah. Native grasslands, never been turned over. I can tell you example after example of where we've brought those things back. But the management going forward has to change to fully check that box. Yeah. Just putting a fire on it, just knocking back the brome and the bluegrass and that sort of thing, and then going back to grazing it, full season grazing with high stocking rates, is not going to produce the result you want.
Man, that's interesting. Okay, so along the lines of grazing, I get this question a lot, and I just have a lot of like, I don't know, we're kind of in the testing phase of this, and I've been selling mixes at a cheaper rate because I tell people like, we don't know the results of these things, but you might. Are there any grasses of the major, maybe 12 grasses that, or mix of grasses that work well as a grazing pasture for any or all of the following: horses, cows, sheep, goats, and I'd put hogs in there.
Well, holy smokes.
You gave me soup to nuts.
I can
tell you that those cows out your way, they like that blue grama.
Yeah. So I believe as a landowner that has native rangeland that has grazing occur on it with cattle, I believe that the grazing mechanism of horses and sheep is very different than cattle. And I'm gonna simplify it. It's not this simple, but cattle basically graze from the top of the plant, moving towards the ground, and horses and sheep basically graze at the ground. Okay,
root it up.
Very, very different grazing mechanism. So with cattle, I think that cattle can be a phenomenal prairie management tool.
Yeah. Okay?
I've used it. If we have, we put prescribed fire on in the spring. We have that black soil. It heats up early. What's the first thing that comes on? The brome and the bluegrass. You turn the cattle in there. And I like to use high intensity, short duration grazing. And the first cow that sticks its head through the fence to try and graze something on the other side of the wire or starts grazing on forbs, they're gone. Okay. And what we do is, it's not a 1 year deal, but over time, we have really changed those grassland ecosystems from being dominated by introduced cool season grasses to those native grasses, warm season grasses, and forbs. Can be a phenomenal tool.
What? So you're saying, I mean, April and May, maybe the first twinge of June. A lot of people want, they want warm season grasses because then that's when the brome's all fried up and they can't get anything for their cows. Would there be anything, do you see any solutions I could suggest to those farmers or those ranchers?
So the first thing is, you have to think very strongly about rotational grazing. Okay. Range land, your pasture ground is divided into paddocks, so that you can control the intensity of the grazing and what they're grazing on. Okay, so then I can take a portion of my farm and ranch and I can focus on we're getting rid of the brome right here. Okay. And then we move them along so that there's rest and recovery and those warm seasons come back. And then they can come back to that sort of thing later on in the year when they actually are going to prefer grazing on those warm seasons. Mm. So, but if it is, if your pasture is one paddock season long grazing, you're not going to have warm season grasses in there. It's going to be dominated by those introduced cool season grasses. So I would say that setting it up in paddocks and rotationally grazing it is a real key there. And then also obviously adding management like prescribed fire and that sort of thing.
Yeah. Well, what have you noticed your cow, what species do you think your cows like the most? Or is it just kind of any of the grass out there they'll really munch on?
So one of the things that we also do, I didn't realize we were going to talk about cattle managing grassland with cattle today. But one of the things, have you ever heard of management that's called patch burn grazing?
No.
Okay. So patch burn grazing is instead of my putting a fence in the pasture and dividing cattle that way, I burn part of the pasture, but not all of it. And here's what happens. The cattle are almost solely on the area that's been burned as those highly nutritious grasses are coming back. So you're maintaining your grazing pressure by the management that you put on of only burning part of it.
Okay, give me timeline. Burn
grazing.
Give me timeline, starting in April. When do you start burning and how long until you burn the next section?
Well, so it's going to depend an awful lot on what kind of cover you have. You know, everything that we do, that all three of us do, whether we're designing a seed mixture or whatever, it should be custom designed.
Mm-hmm.
Same thing for that pasture management. But in rangeland, I'm a big believer in burning as early in the year as you can. Burn it in March, because in rangeland, when those things start greening up, all of a sudden it can be challenging to get a burn in April and that sort of thing. So we have to burn it when we have the fuel and we'll get the response. Because one of the things we're trying to do is get rid of cedar trees as well. Mm. So we want a hot, intense fire. We need to be burning early in the prescribed burning season on at least part of it. So that would be my answer there. And then after that, it's all part of how your plan is designed and where you're going to burn and when you're going to burn. But those cattle are absolutely going to go to those burned areas because it is highly, highly nutritious new grass growth that's coming on. And you couldn't keep them off of it if you tried.
Wow.
So that burning timeline then, it makes sense to burn that early because you get the hot fire. But that hot fire is not setting back the cool season invasives. Those are coming on earlier, possibly, because less, you know, more sunlight, warmer soil temp from sun beating on the black soot. But then the cows are taking care of the cool season management for you by trimming those things down so that in time, those warm season grasses, as they start shooting back up, they got the upper hand. Now, how does that compare to, so what we do around here a lot is we don't have the grazing component. We just have the fire component. Right. And is it best then, have you found, if you're not going to graze, to burn into late April, early mid-May, because now you're burning when these cool season grasses are in their growing season and you're setting them back, you're hurting them while they're growing.
Absolutely. So when I said I want to burn in March, that's because I'm doing what I call the philosophy of 1 + 2 = 4.
Mm.
Okay. Here's what I mean. When we burn in March, we've set it back. That plant has used some of its nutrient reserves to go, and it's out there growing like crazy, then we're bringing the cattle in. If we didn't bring the cattle in that situation that I just described, we would be enhancing the brome.
Yeah. Right.
So that's where, if we didn't have the cattle component, then we slide exactly to what you said, Kent, which is I want to burn it as late as I can when that smooth brome or whatever else has really put all of its energy into growing, and then I want to smack it.
Mm-hmm.
So yeah. The one plus really two equals four is where I'm taking fire plus grazing. I'm combining management activities to get a greater result than either one of them would get on their own.
That's really interesting. I wonder if, as I know, there's a guy not far from us who does a lot of, he has a grazing service through his goat herd. And obviously goats have the advantage of, you know, they can, you know, they walk up trees essentially, you know, and they'll get everything like from chest high down, you know, eliminated. But I wonder if that would be a good thing to try and partner with somebody on, as far as, you know, prairie management is, you do that earlier burn in March and then, hey, get a guy with goats to come in. I wonder if the goats would be as effective as the cows.
I would worry that they would not, because goats are browsers. They want to be eating your brush and your trees and your fence posts and your wire, and
they're gonna ignore the brome and the Kentucky blue.
I think that cattle are so keyed in on those grasses, and in what we've talked about, where we've enhanced the grasses that we want to get rid of, you couldn't keep them off of it if you tried to.
What about?
So that's why it really works well.
Yeah, we've got really
interesting.
So one of our fields, I think it's like 25 acres of big bluestem. Let's say we burned April 10th, and then we called someone and said, "Hey, can you bring your cattle on over here?" I mean, we've got neighbors who have cows. You know, it'd be pretty easy. It'd basically be opening the fence, and letting them over there. And then from April 15th till so and so, would that affect our big bluestem's ability to reproduce seed? I imagine it would help.
So it's all timing. Okay.
Yep.
And meaning the timing of when you would bring the cattle there. And if you bring the cattle in when that big bluestem, not when it's 4 feet tall, you know, but when it's 12 to 20, 25 inches, highly nutritious, those cattle would be on that like crazy, and you would significantly impact the amount of big bluestem that you would have there. And if the effort is, we know that big bluestem just responds like crazy to fire, right? So if the goal is, I want to burn it because I need all these other benefits, but I don't want the big bluestem to go bananas, and I don't want it to outcompete the forbs, here is, again, you're taking management activity one plus two, and you're getting a bigger impact, where you would use fire, stimulate the big bluestem. The cattle are going to love it when they're there at the right time. Not when it's 4 feet tall, 5 feet tall, that sort of thing. But earlier on, boy, they would be on that like a chicken on a June bug.
Yeah. Interesting. So it's not great for production purposes in the field, but it's really good for management purposes is what I would say.
You know, if you wanted to produce as much big bluestem as you could, just do the fire and, you know, and
that's what we do.
I mean, it's crazy what the response of big bluestem is to fire. It's just bananas.
Except when you're in a drought for 2.5 straight years, it can struggle, but
I'll just tell you that drought is a relative term, and I'm telling you that you gentlemen in Iowa don't know what drought is.
No.
In 2012, I had 8.3 inches for the entire year. Man, and I'm normally a 32 inch location.
Yeah.
I had cracks in the ground in my prairie that I swear I could have dropped a quarter down, you know, 12, 15 feet into the ground.
Man, it's crazy.
That is so crazy. Anyway, we've really gone far afield here today.
That's good. That's what that's I love good. About podcasts.
Here's the deal. If I have to keep looking to an outline that I send you to keep the conversation going, then the conversation is probably not very conversation-y. It's more like chatting with a robot, and those are not good, or least listened to. You know what's shocking? You know what's I think it's fourth all time? Is a conversation that you commented on, I believe, with Justin Meisen from the Tallgrass Prairie Center. What's really interesting is that dude, we got in the minutia of growing prairie. I mean, stuff that I was like, nobody can relate to this. Nobody's listening to this, you know, and they did. They loved it. I think a big part of it is a lot of the people who listen to this love prairie. So they actually knew what we were talking about. Mm-hmm. But
Justin, this is awesome. Yeah.
How can this not excite your passion and that sort of thing? I mean, it's just, it's cool stuff. And I'll just tell you a really brief story about my path about it. My grandparents immigrated to America from Denmark. Berthelsen is a good, strong Danish name. Let me tell you, they immigrated from Denmark to America. And when they came over, they were engaged, but they were smart enough to not be married. And the reason is because that gave them two chances instead of one in the homestead lottery. And my grandmother, with the raffle ticket number of number 1723, won a quarter section of ground in White River, South Dakota.
Wow.
That win was so big that it did two things. One, it instilled a passion for prairies and grasslands that's just part of my chromogenes. It's just, it's in me. The second thing it did was it was such a big win that it wiped my family's luck at all gaming chances out for three generations because I've never in my life.
That's a great story. That's awesome.
It's just part of me. It's you know, I didn't know really what a land ethic was and that sort of thing. Well, I have a very deep land ethic now, and that I just feel passionately and personally, and I love being just a small bit player in helping other people with their land ethic and helping them to meet what their land ethic is by helping them with seeds and prairies and management and all that kind of stuff. It's just very deeply rewarding.
Man, well, Peter, only because Kent and I have a little bit of a timeline today, we have to start wrapping up. But the good news is that we hardly got to anything on the outline.
Let's do it again then.
That's right. We're
gonna come back here shortly. This was amazing. This was so
great,
amazing
conversation.
And, you know, a lot of times I ask things for the listeners, but basically everything I asked you today was for me. I feel like I got not a 101. I feel like I got a 501 in prairie
credits.
Well, I feel like I got utility prairie education. I don't mean utility as in like power companies. I mean utility as in like practical. Where can the prairie go? How can we get more prairie on the land? And that is really cool. You know, we got to be thinking, yes, some against the system of how the system goes, but we got to work with the system. You know, it's just how the world works. And so if we can shift it and move the needle like Pete does, that's the dream. So before we go, people hear your stuff. Wow, this guy's really cool. Or I'm in Nebraska, and I want to burn some fields, or I want to learn how to do it. How can people get a hold of you? Where can they see more of your stuff or connect with you?
Well, social media is a biggie. We have a Facebook account. We're on LinkedIn, Twitter, that sort of thing. And we've really enjoyed trying to put a lot of stuff on social media about how we clean individual species and videos and posts and that sort of thing. And it seems to get a really good response. So we really like that. Obviously we have a website and all of that kind of stuff, but we're really trying to put a bunch of time into social media. And, you know, we don't have a podcast and I don't ever see us having one. we'll let the experts like you guys handle that. But we do really try to put a lot of effort in there. So if you're interested in pollinators, wildflowers, prairies, seeds, all that kind of stuff, we're putting posts up all the time on that kind of stuff, because just like you commented with that past podcast that generated so much interest, how could you not be interested in that stuff?
Great
that
point.
Is really cool. Do you ever do field trips on any of the prairies that you either help manage or own? That's cool. Well, people, you know that if you want to grow passion, or if you've got like a spouse or a kid that you're like, they should be passionate about this thing too, instead of just forcing it into them, force them to go to a prairie, and then it'll just seep into them naturally. That's how it works. and we really appreciate it. Go ahead and go to Conservation Blueprint on Facebook. Give them a follow. Stay up to date. Learn more about prairie. Because even if you're not doing tons of things with prairie, it's just something. If you live in an area where there once was vast prairie, it's something we should be aware of. We should be connected to it. And Pete, thanks so much for being with us. That's a really cool thing that you'd be willing to sit down and share your vast knowledge, and we'll continue to share here in the future. Appreciate it.
Yeah. Thanks guys. I've really, really thoroughly enjoyed today's conversation, and hope your listeners do as well, because this is great stuff we're doing. So thank you for what you guys are doing too. Really appreciate it.
You represented the most underrated state very well. I think this could be Nebraska sacrilege here, but I think you guys should change your collegiate mascot from the Cornhuskers to the Prairie Burners. I think that'd be a lot.
That would be so fun. Oh man. Here, if you have a petition, I'll move to Nebraska to be able to sign that, having a Nebraska address, man, that'd be so cool.
We'll see what we can do.
Oh man. Well, and also, if people don't know what burning prairie is like, that might seem more terrible than anything else. You know, they burn their own prairie. All right. Well, thank you so much, Pete. And as everyone knows, we really believe that podcasts can change a lot. So please rate and share this podcast. If you give us a 5-star review, we will be very grateful. If you don't want to give us a 5-star review, feel free to not rate it or shoot an email. You know, but and just like Pete is moving the needle, something you guys can do to move the needle is share the podcast. Because when people hear this, when they hear other people's experience, or they hear something that convinces them to have an experience, it helps they change their mind. And that's what conservation needs, because conservation happens one mind at a time.